Well, good evening. Welcome back to One Step Beyond. In effect, divide, I should say, the broadcast this evening into two parts. We're going to begin by picking up where we left off last time and finishing some material that was originally intended for broadcast last week. And then we're going to, after finishing up the King Alfred plan, Rex 84, etc., we're going to talk about update a number of different articles. But I'm going to give you a summary of what we're going to be listening to in the first part and then summarize the second part when that happens. Now, we're going to begin by taking a look at an article that I'm sure many of you noticed, the death this past week of Carl Spitz Channel. That's the head. He's the former head of Western Goals, a private, quote-unquote, intelligence organization, which, although technically private, nominally private, has very strong connections to the national security establishment and people involved with the Iran-Contra scandal in particular. The unfortunate late Mr. Channel died apparently of complications resulting from an automobile accident. He was hit by a car while recovering from cancer. Like so many of these deaths, you never know. We don't know and probably never will know for sure whether that automobile accident was indeed an accident or just a quiet way of seeing to it that Spitz didn't spill the beans about some of the things he might have spilled the beans about, or whether it was a warning to Spitz Channel or others that they better not spill the beans is anybody's guess. But we're going to talk about the death of Spitz Channel briefly, and then we're going to talk about the Western Goals' involvement with some of the state defense forces. Now, in a supplement to a miscellaneous archive show that's based either live or in print on the work of researcher Ed Connolly, who's done some excellent work on the state defense forces, we looked at an article from the San Francisco Bay Guardian from late last year, in which, or maybe it was early this year, in which the involvement of not only some Aryan Nations groups, but also the aforementioned Western Goals with some of the state defense forces, these militia that have been put together to basically police the United States in the event of an emergency. Those militia figure prominently in the Rex 84 martial law contingency plan, which was touched on during the Iran-Contra hearings, was dealt with at greater length by the Christic Institute suit, and which may or may not be related to an allegedly fictional document called the King Alfred plan that we will be talking about later. It's interesting that we have Spitz Channel and Western Goals indoctrinating these very same state defense forces, because Western Goals was involved in a very important case a few years ago in which elements of the Los Angeles Police Department, specifically the Public Disorder Intelligence Division, which grew out of the criminal conspiracy section that we talked about in Radio Free America 23, based in considerable measure on the work of the late, great Mae Brussel, the criminal conspiracy section was a section of the Los Angeles Police Department which was involved with political activities, specifically the setting up of provocations, terrorist incidents to be blamed on the opposition, in cooperation with elements of the national security establishment, specifically elements of FBI and CIA. We're going to talk about Spitz Channel, the state defense forces, and I'm going to reflect a little bit on the sorry state of our economy, because I think a lot of the developments that are looming on the horizon are going to be very directly connected to this country's economic situation. I personally am very, very frightened about the immediate future. I've been frightened about the future for a long time, but I see all the signs of some real economic disaster. Perhaps it can be avoided. I hope so, but I see signs of panic on the outside. That when George Bush is talking about raising taxes, that's something that you can see as that you can view as a sign that things are a lot worse than most people would like us to believe. And I'm afraid that in the event of an economic crisis, whether it's one that takes place slowly or over a period of years or perhaps even decades, or whether it happens in one big fell swoop like the collapse of 29, or whether it, as I said, it continues to happen incrementally, because our economy is disintegrating quite quickly, but it's disintegrating in stages. Well, whether which of those two scenarios happens is anybody's guess, but I personally am terrified about the state of the economy and what that's likely to do. Because in the event of an economic collapse, and whether it happens slowly over a period of years or even decades, or whether it happens quickly, I cannot see how this country is going to avoid a political catastrophe, because frankly, I don't think the American people have the character to withstand something like that. And it should never be forgotten that in the first place, fascism in general and Nazism in particular was to a considerable measure, not entirely, but to a considerable measure an outgrowth of multinational corporate capitalism, and that's something we will be going into in 2 weeks. And when you think about the fact that it was the severe social dislocation experienced by the German people both during the Great Depression, which was worse in Germany than in most other countries, and also the hyperinflation in the Weimar Republic in the early 20s, well, the social dislocation produced by that plus the shame, the ire felt by the military in Germany over their combined defeat in World War I, plus the fact that that defeat was hastened to a certain extent by, well, actually it wasn't hastened, but it was punctuated by an abortive communist revolution in Germany, and that enabled the German general staff to circulate the stab-in-the-back hypothesis, which basically blamed their defeat on this abortive revolution, which actually happened after General Ludendorff. He was the German chief of the German general staff. After Ludendorff had basically was in the process of surrendering, then that revolution happened. So although it coincided with the end of World War I, it actually took place after the deal was done. However, the German general staff blamed their defeat on that revolution, and that served as a pretext for, in their minds, eliminating, or they didn't eliminate in their minds, they eliminated, in fact, the political opposition. Not just communists, but Democrats, socialists of all stripes were eliminated in Weimar Germany, and those death squads, the so-called Freikorps or Black Reichswehr, those death squads paved the way for Hitler's rise to power. And I see a lot of ominous parallels with what's going on today, and it is my fear that in the event of an economic collapse, we will see scapegoating much along the lines of what took place in Germany. It may not be the Jews, although probably the Jews will be gotten rid of at some point, but it'll be the blacks and other non-white minorities, I suspect, that will be among the first to feel the lash if, in fact, there is an economic collapse, and that's a possibility I don't think we can overlook. So we're going to begin after our discussion of Spitz Channel, what may have happened to him, connections to the state defense forces. We're also going to take a look at a couple of articles that I reviewed, that I looked at last week. We will review this week one, an article in which the experts say the war on drugs has turned into a war on blacks. Well, that's something that I had predicted, and again, I don't take any satisfaction in these predictions. This is a very frightening and depressing development to me, right? I mean, I could pop the microphone down now and either cry or puke, depending, or first maybe one and then the other, depending. But the fact of the matter is, I call this shot, as I've called an awful lot of others, and I wish I was wrong about some of these things, but when you study history, the world is not a mystery, and I've studied it at least up to a point, and I see very, very serious things happening in this country, and I am terrified for the future, and I'm going to share some of my fears and the reasons for them this evening. We're going to talk about how the war on drugs has turned into a war on blacks. I had speculated about the war on drugs as sort of a creeping Rex 84. We're also going to look at a real terrifying proposal. I don't know if it'll ever get off the ground, but a very terrifying proposal by William Bennett, the drug czar and former Reagan education secretary, to relocate children from certain inner city areas where the drug problem is really bad. And well, when you start relocating population groups, that is ominously reminiscent of what happened in Nazi Germany. The Jews, recall, were never told that they were being killed. A lot of people realized that they were simply being relocated. And as the conditions in the ghettos in Europe worsened over a period of time, a lot of them were quite happy to leave or to get their children out in hopes that they would be taken someplace less grinding than where they were. And we're going to talk about those articles. We're going to talk about the economy, social scapegoating, and we're also going to talk about the Rex 84 martial law plan and the King Alfred plan. And we are also going to be going into some, well, I'm going to review information. It will be review for those of you who have heard it before and new for those of you who haven't. Some critical information from Radio Free America program number 32. That is the, let's see, 29, 30, 31, the fourth program in the now seven-part Radio Free America series about the Iran-Contra scandal. And in Radio Free America program number 32, entitled Staging the Fourth Reich, we're going to listen to a comparison between the Rex 84 martial law contingency plan and the King Alfred plan, a supposedly fictional document, which, if it's in fact fictional, is an awfully interesting coincidence that that allegedly fictional document has now cropped up in an all-too-real context. And we're going to hear that section of Radio Free America 32 about the King Alfred plan and the Rex 84 martial law contingency plan. The King Alfred plan basically representing, as it appears, a contingency plan for the final solution to the Negro problem. And we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the State Defense Forces, Rex 84, and reflect on the war on drugs. And for people to think something like that is absolutely outlandish, and as I said at the top of the broadcast, new people will find this very startling, stick around, because we're going to review another tape. And again, I apologize to veteran listeners who have heard this already, but we're adding new people all the time, and I think it's important sometimes to go back to some of these more fundamental tapes and review the archives so that we can see things in perspective. We're going to listen to an interview with Leo Ryan legislative aide Joe Holsinger, done in May of 1980. In fact, done on the very day that the Uncle Sam and the Swastika program was recorded. And this is an interview with Joe Holsinger where he talks about very disturbing indications that, in fact, Jonestown was a U.S. intelligence operation. And he will discuss that information, and you will be able to compare, I guess, how easy it was for Jonestown, which, granted, happened in Guyana, did not happen in the United States, but people didn't blink. And the ominous indications that that whole thing was a compromised intelligence operation, and that is why the massacre happened. We will review those for people that perhaps find the possibility of Rex 84 incredible. That'll be the first part of the broadcast, and then I'm going to review information. Well, I'm just going to, I shouldn't say review information, but run through relatively briefly a number of articles updating various aspects of things we've been talking about, in particular a number of articles touching on the CIA connection to the SNL scandal. But I will give you a rundown of those articles as we begin the second part of the show. We're going to take a short musical break, and then I'm going to launch into the death of Spitz Channel, the Western Goals connections to the State Defense Forces, and ruminate a bit about some of my fears for the immediate future. Now, we're going to begin by taking a look at the obituary this past week of Carl Spitz Channel. He was the first man convicted in the Iran-Contra scandal, albeit with a wrist slap, and he also passed away this past week. Remains to be seen just exactly whether I doubt we will ever learn whether his death was indeed the accidental natural death that it's presented as being. But in Radio Free America program number 33, the fifth in the seven-part ongoing Radio Free America series about the Iran-Contra scandal, we took a look at the numerous deaths connected with the Iran-Contra scandal. A lot of the key players, a lot of key witnesses bowed out under strange circumstances as the case developed. Most papers carried accounts of Carl Spitz's death, Carl Spitz Channel's death, I should say. This particular one comes from the San Jose Mercury News of Wednesday, May 9th of 1990. This is an AP story, Dateline Washington, headlined, "Fundraiser Who Pleaded Guilty to Charges in Iran-Contra Affair Dies." Carl Spitz Channel, the first person to plead guilty to illegal Iran-Contra activities, has died of pneumonia while being treated for massive injuries suffered in a car accident, associates said Tuesday. The conservative fundraiser, who was 44, died Monday at George Washington University Hospital, said hospital spokeswoman Terry Abdu, A-B-D-O-O. Channel pleaded guilty in April of 1987 to conspiring to defraud the government by using his tax-exempt foundation to raise money for the Nicaraguan Contra rebels. The plea marked the first break for special prosecutors in their investigation of the Iran-Contra case. He later assisted prosecutors in the investigation of the sale of American arms to Iran and the diversion of profits to the Contras. That last sentence again, because it's one that I think is worth pondering. He later assisted prosecutors in the investigation of the sale of American arms to Iran and the diversion of profits to the Contras. Former Representative Dan Kuykendall, a friend of Channel, said Channel had been undergoing chemotherapy for lung cancer and recovered enough to do consulting. But he was struck by an automobile March 15th near his Southeast Washington office, said Kuykendall, now a Capitol Hill lobbyist. And basically it goes on to describe a little bit about his activities. Well, we'll never know exactly why he was hit by a car, Gal. Gosh knows that's common enough to get hit by a car or die in an automobile accident. It happens all the time. It's also one of the authorities' favorite ways of getting rid of somebody if they want to make it look like an accident. Now, one of the questions I have is whether or not his cooperation with the prosecution, such as it was, may have earned him some retribution on the part of some of those who did not find his contribution, his cooperation with the prosecutors to be to their liking. Basically, within organized crime syndicates, and that's basically what the so-called secret team, as the Christic Institute refers to the Iran-Contra players as, within organized crime syndicates, basically omerta, the law of silence, is the rule. You don't, even if you get nailed, you don't betray your comrades, and Spitz Channel, at least to a certain extent, did cooperate with the investigation. Then I wonder, something that I think needs to be investigated, is whether or not that car that took him out on March 15th was doing so on behalf of some of his irate colleagues. That obviously is not something we can say for sure at this time, but at the same time, with the legacy of political murder in this country and with the sorts of cute activities that I described in the beginning of the broadcast, not as drastic, the things that have happened to the Brussels family, the Brussels daughters, I should say, the things that have happened to me, this type of thing is not something that can be overlooked. And as I like to say, food for thought and grounds for further research. And I guess inasmuch as Spitz Channel was nailed on March 15th, we could say beware the Ides of March. And we also, I think, should ruminate about Western goals and about the significance of its operations. And in particular, we're going to touch, I'm not going to read you from the documentation because I've read the article a couple of times in the past, but there was an article in the San Francisco Bay Guardian by Ed Connolly. And he described, among other things, not only numerous Aryan Nations connections to the state militias, the state defense forces, which would be activated in the event of the Rex 84 martial law contingency plan. And we're going to get to that later. But it should be noted that a lot of their indoctrination, or some of their indoctrination, came from films and presentations developed by Western Goals. Now, that's a private right-wing intelligence organization. The word private really here belongs in quotes because it has very strong connections to people within the national security establishment. John Singlaub, former head of the World Anti-Communist League, and himself a key player in the Contra support effort, is a member of the board of directors. Edward Teller is a member of the board of directors. And it is basically a private right-wing intelligence organization which intersects with the government. They're noted for collecting files and developing files on people whose politics they disagree. In 1984, well, actually, it broke before 1984. I guess it actually first hit the news in 83, maybe late 82. But in 1983, there was a case that exploded and did not get the publicity it deserved. Elements of the Los Angeles Police Department had been collecting private intelligence on, law-abiding citizens, but people with whose politics they disagreed. The information was being placed into a computer bank, and interestingly enough, that not only was the computer bank, there was a computer bank in the United States and a matching computer bank in Germany, if you can figure that out. Interestingly enough, The same organization, which just got a wrist slap, it was sued by the ACLU. It's touched on, by the way, in Radio Free America 23, a supplement to it. Interestingly enough, in the course of the investigation. There really was never a complete investigation. In other words, that the all of the information that might have come out didn't. And it's intriguing to find, many years later, Western Goals involved with not only the Iran-Contra scandal, but Western Goals involved with indoctrinating the very state militias, the state defense forces, which would be called up in the event of an activation of Rex 84. Now, Rex 84 was a contingency plan developed by elements of the Reagan White House in which neo-Nazis, survivalists, Aryan Nation types would be deputized and literally made federal agents in order to round up political dissidents, Central American refugees, and others in the event of any one of a number of national emergencies, either a terrorist incident of some kind, or in the event of widespread protest to an American invasion, say, of Central America. There were contingency plans developed to suspend the U.S. Constitution in the event of an emergency and place an undetermined number of Americans in detention camps. This was brought up during the Iran-Contra hearings by Representative Jack Brooks, but that basically Jack Brooks was shunted off by Daniel Inouye, and the information never really came out as it might have. We touched on that last week on the martial law contingency plan, and we're going to touch on it, and we're going to go back to it again tonight in a big way. I think it's very, very serious, and should not be. We should not underestimate the implications of seeing an organization like Western Goals, on the one hand, collecting political intelligence and developing files on law-abiding citizens, just people with whose politics they disagree, and then in turn they're indoctrinating the very defense forces, which would be state defense forces, which would be activated in the event of a suspension of the Constitution. And I also wonder, too, whether elements of those state defense forces might take a more activist role, and if indeed they view citizens with whose politics they disagree as subversives, whether perhaps they take a more activist role, and whether some of those subversives are in fact being done in. I don't know, but there are a lot of indications of death squad activity in this country. I myself once talked to, at considerable length on the phone, an individual who claimed to be a member of an American military death squad, and from everything he had to say, it sounded pretty convincing to me. And again, this was an American military death squad that operated in the United States on American citizens. One of the most ominous aspects of elements of the state defense force is not just their infiltration by Aryan Nations groups and their contacts with organizations like Western Goals, but one of the most ominous aspects of this, those organizations, is the fact that many of them, and I'm not knocking Vietnam veterans, but many of them are, one might say, disgruntled Vietnam veterans. That is to say, Vietnam veterans who are looking to settle a score. Because one of the aspects of America's political history that has not really been dealt with effectively is the large number of Vietnam veterans who basically came back viewing the anti-war movement and people in it as traitors. And indeed, I myself am fiercely critical of large elements of the anti-war movement, the flag burners and so forth. There really has never been an effective treatment of the tremendous bitterness that large numbers of Vietnam veterans and Americans in general, in particular relatives or friends of Vietnam veterans, the tremendous bitterness that was felt towards elements of the anti-war movement or the anti-war movement in general, whom they saw as traitors. And in certain instances, I have to agree, not that the war was right, the war was absolutely wrong, and the murder of the President of the United States precipitated that war or enabled it. And I myself protested against the war, although I very quickly became almost as opposed to the anti-war movement as to the war itself, because I was repelled by an awful lot of what I saw. And the type of things that repelled me and that I think crossed the line from legitimate protest into treason are things like burning the flag, which is in and of itself maybe a small act, but the fact of the matter is that's an outrageous thing to do in front of people that have just come home from a war. You don't fight in a war and just come back and begin crocheting lace doilies. There has been a lot of discussion about post-traumatic stress syndrome and about the tremendous effects of combat on the human physiology and the human psyche. An awful lot of young guys, and maybe some not so young guys too, came back from the horrors of Vietnam to see Americans, and whether they were sincere or whether they were agent provocateur, doing things like burning the flag, the famous picture of Jane Fonda sighting through an anti-aircraft gun. Nobody has really paid much attention to the effect that had on a lot of Americans. To a considerable extent, the anti-war movement and related elements, certain elements, the more militant and irresponsible elements of the Black Power movement, really alienated middle America from liberal politics. Blue-collar America, to a considerable extent, was driven into the arms of the far right by the more irresponsible elements of 60s politics. So-called black militants like people like H. Rapp Brown and others who called for the burning down of America, the people like Abbie Hoffman and others who like to burn the flag or otherwise abuse the symbols of America, the people who went down the street shouting, ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh, NLF is going to win. Those people were seen as traitors by an awful lot of America, including and especially the military and Vietnam veterans. And I can't say for sure, I wouldn't call them traitors as such, but a lot of elements of that type of expression really come awfully close to treason. They don't actually betray the country, but they betray the spirit of the country as it is meant to be. It's one thing to protest an unjust policy. It's another thing to do something that is deeply wounding and insulting to one's fellow citizens. There were a lot of people who lost friends in the war, a lot of people who lost relatives, and the pain of those experiences is very much with them today. And every time, say, someone that lost a husband or a brother or a father in the war, or a veteran who lost friends in the war, or just somebody who believes in the more traditional elements of American, well, actually American political mythology at this point, because they've been pretty thoroughly betrayed, those acts, burning the flag, in particular Jane Fonda sighting through a North Vietnamese anti-aircraft gun, are seen as treason. And I'm not going to say that ipso facto they're treason, but they are outrageous. And the thing that's important to understand is not whatever political label one might put on them, but the experience of people who, middle Americans, so to speak, people who lost friends or relatives or people who were there, when they see things like the flag being burned and they think back on the students who had a student deferment and didn't have to go, or whether, in particular, if they look at Jane Fonda sighting through the anti-aircraft gun, they are basically seeing someone, for all practical purposes, endorsing the death and the suffering that their friends or relatives or comrades experienced. There are people every day in this country who wake up, and every day for them is an ordeal psychologically. They think about the pain that they saw, that, you know, those who were there, or they think about the loss of a brother or a husband or a father or whatever. And when they think about the burning of flags, when they think about Jane Fonda sighting through a North Vietnamese anti-aircraft weapon, that basically places them in a frame of mind not unlike the frame of mind which prevailed among the German general staff and large sections of the German veterans population after World War I, in which those elements of German society who rose up in an abortive communist revolution were seen as traitors. Now, in fact, General Ludendorff had basically already set the peace process in motion. The German defeat was already assured. But when the communist revolution happened, and it was an abortive one, it was put down, this was seen not only by veterans of the war, but also by the general staff in particular, and also large elements, of course, of the German industrial and financial community as treason. And President Ebert of the Weimar Republic put together three organizations, the Freikorps, the Eine Wohnerwehren, and the Zeit Freiwilligenverbande, which were paramilitary organizations of newly demobilized veterans who were then remobilized for the purposes of putting down the communist revolution. They did so, and they then remained to a large extent intact, even though they were supposed to be disbanded. And after putting down the communists, they then proceeded to eliminate all elements of German democracy, anybody who might have opposed Adolf Hitler, who began his career as a German military intelligence agent under the Reichswehr political department of General von Lossow. Now, we discussed that in Radio Free America program number 10, and there's also a miscellaneous old Hard Rain show which discusses this as well. But the main Radio Free America reference is Radio Free America number 10, which has that two-part Hard Rain show describing the Freikorps and the events in Germany in the immediate aftermath of World War I in some detail. So RFA number 10 is the reference you want to look into under the circumstances. And all of this, all the discussion of Vietnam and what happened, what didn't happen, is relevant in my mind because as we evaluate what's going on in this country and we evaluate the psychology of people involved, some of the people, I should say, and I don't want to damn the state defense forces as being a bunch of violent reactionaries, but a lot of them are. And a lot of them are people who came out of Vietnam totally poisoned and who would be quite willing to shoot peace protesters or anybody else because they see them as traitors. And every time they pull the trigger, they will be seeing Jane Fonda sighting through the North Vietnamese anti-aircraft gun or Abby Hoffman burning an American flag or kids shouting ho, 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 Ho Chi Minh, NLF is going to win. And I think people should pay a great deal of attention to that portion of the American psyche because it really has not been discussed in the progressive sector to any extent. And my feeling is that that bitterness, that unfinished business from Vietnam is likely to turn into a deadly political whirlwind in this country in the not too distant future. In the event of a Rex 84 mobilization for whatever reason. Now, last week, we looked at an observation by an author named Lawrence Wexler, who has written a book about the U.S. involvement and in political torture and military dictatorship in Uruguay and Brazil. And he spoke with an Uruguayan political scientist, and she said basically that military dictatorship could happen in any country. What is needed is a mixture of political paralysis and economic crisis. And it is my fear that just such a thing could happen in this country. It's scary to me to read the papers and the news and see the really deadly signs of an impending collapse. We are now the world's biggest creditor nation, or biggest debtor nation, rather, and 10 short years from being the world's biggest creditor nation, and virtually every major institution in this country is bankrupt. The corporations, a lot of them, are in very bad shape. They're in need of cash flow. The country itself is bankrupt. The governments, to a large extent, are. The municipalities are, many of them, not all of them. But there is a major fiscal crunch coming around, and it's coming around for the state of California. It's coming around for the country as a whole. It may be made much worse by the SNL crisis. And who knows what we're not being told, because generally speaking, our news media soft pedal the general political situation. They do not talk about what is there to be discussed. They talk about what they would rather have us hear, and generally that's a lot of nonsense. And the news media are getting really, really bad about focusing on BS. You know, one hears all about Twin Peaks, and who killed, what's her name. You hear all about The Simpsons. I have the good fortune to be on the air on Sunday night. I don't watch much commercial TV anyway, but I can't believe the extent to which people are getting all stupid behind this cartoon show. I mean, I read about it all the time in the papers. I don't feel I have to watch it at this point. Or people can spend all their time, let's say the editors of the papers are spending an inordinate amount of time on non-news these days. One of the stories, it's got to be the biggest non-story of the decade, in my opinion, is all of the copy that's being devoted to these giant frogs. The Calaveras County Frog Jumping Contest has been an event for a number of years, and some guy got an idea of importing these giant frogs called the Goliath frogs, and I don't know whether they come from Africa or South America, But he's going to enter them, or has entered them, I don't know when it happens, in this Calaveras County Jumping Frog Contest. And there have been articles in virtually every paper in the country, and a lot of papers have repeated articles over and over on these frogs. It is, like I said, I've seen a lot of non-stories, but this could be the worst of the lot. It's a totally insignificant story, and it's getting incredible amount of coverage. I sometimes feel, in my attempts to relay a more intelligent and meaningful interpretation of news events, and when you're faced with stuff like the Goliath frogs, I mean, I kind of feel like David versus the Goliath frogs, I guess you could say. And I think the editors who are devoting all of that copy to this nonsense really should be ashamed of themselves. I wish the editors who are devoting all this time to these frogs would croak under the circumstances. But if they don't have the Goliath frogs, they'll have plenty of other stuff. I'll get a human interest story, quote unquote, about, oh, I don't know, a delicatessen owner who builds a replica of Elvis out of dill pickle chips, or, you know, the usual jive about Madonna, or the latest jive about Marla Maples, or, you know, cheesecake photo of Fawn Hall, or something else equally meaningful. And it shouldn't be too hard for them to soft pedal the news, and there's a lot of that going. People are not paying attention to what's going on. And I think the signs of an economic collapse are impending. And I don't know how soon it's going to happen. Maybe the central banks can regulate things. I don't know. We're in uncharted economic waters. But I'm not very optimistic about the future. And I see, as I read the papers, in spite of all the jive news, I see an awful lot of very, very serious indications that we are headed over the falls, economically speaking. With all of the debt, I can't see how we're going to get out of this. I do not see a solution to America's economic problems, and I'm afraid that's going to lead to a final solution. Now, one of the reasons that I talk about the multinational corporate connections to fascism and the fact that many of the dominant industrial and financial interests that preside over our society are some of the same interests that backed Adolf Hitler during the Second World War. Some of them played both sides, but they were pro-Hitler, they were pro-Nazi, they liked what happened, is that in this country, we have already seen a social, political, and to a certain extent, psychological process, which is analogous in some ways. I'm not saying it's a perfect analogy. I'm not sure there is any such thing as a perfect historical analogy. But I see things which are analogous to what happened in Germany. As I mentioned last week, and as I've mentioned in weeks past, many of the key Nazi leaders, notably Eichmann, who actually engineered the final solution, Hitler's liquidation of the Jews, they were very candid in some of their personal reminiscences and musings about the fact that the Jews were not actually responsible for Germany's problems, but that somebody had to be held responsible so that society could remain united. Germany needed a scapegoat and an external enemy within the inside. And to a considerable extent, I think black people and minorities in this country are being scapegoated, although not as yet to the same extent, for America's economic problems. The reason why, in my opinion anyway, the reason why Ronald Reagan and George Bush after him was able to get away with holding down government spending, whereas they completely rewrote the book on government spending, is that when people listen to them, when middle America listens to Ronald Reagan talk about holding down government spending, they're not talking about holding down government spending. That's a code word for let's get all the niggers and the Mexicans and the Puerto Ricans off of welfare, and maybe while we're at it, we'll fix all of what George Wallace referred to as the pointy-headed liberals who are responsible for it. If there is a lot of discussion in middle America about welfare, about people on welfare, and about how they don't want to work, and this is what is responsible for America's economic problems. The reason why it is my opinion that the Willie Horton ploy by the Bush campaign in 1988 was so effective is that it played to that very mentality. It played to the let's get the niggers mentality. They're on welfare. They're causing our problems. And as ludicrous as it is to present welfare as the cause of America's economic problems, and in particular 85% of the people on welfare are white, the fact of the matter is we're not talking about a rational process here. We're talking about a process of political and psychological scapegoating, and it is already a process process, which is underway. And it is my fear that if that process of economic disintegration accelerates, and there are very serious signs that it's going to, then we will see an acceleration in the degree and, in the amount of and degree, the severity of the scapegoating. It is my belief that if this country experiences a financial collapse, and none of us really knows whether that's going to happen, it may happen suddenly, it might happen over a period of years or decades, that my belief is it's happening now, gradually but quickly. In the event of an economic collapse, I do not think that Americans are going to accept responsibility for having created their own situation. I don't see a great deal of character in this country right now, and I do not think that people are going to accept the blame for having caused their own problems and followed that smiling old fool down the road to ruin, which they did, the old fool in this case being Ronald Reagan. And I do not see, in the event of an economic collapse, an economic crisis, the kind of economic crisis that Uruguayan political scientists referred to, I do not see Americans biting the bullet, so to speak. I cannot see people in this society biting the bullet. And the fact of the matter is, if they don't bite the bullet, then they're going to have to eat something a whole lot less appetizing, albeit more easily chewed under the circumstances. And I don't think they're going to accept responsibility. I think they're going to go looking for somebody to blame. And the handiest scapegoat so far has been non-white minorities. Now, one of the things that I observed in connection with the war on drugs, which is quite ludicrous because the very same government which is waging the war on drugs is very much involved with bringing the drugs into the country. Also, there's an article in today's papers, in fact, about how the Afghan guerrillas, the Mujahideen, being supported by our government, are heavily involved in the opium traffic, in the heroin traffic, and yet the government is not interested in doing much about it. Well, there's an area where the war on drugs could be successfully fought, but instead we're seeing the gradual introduction of the military into civilian society in a civilian law enforcement role, and the constitutional implications of that could not be exaggerated. In William Bennett's as yet unsuccessful attempt to clean the drugs out of Washington, D.C., a number of agents from the Defense Intelligence Agency are being used in a domestic law enforcement capacity. I observed when these programs were put into effect that this not only was very ominous from a constitutional standpoint, but that to a considerable extent it represented a creeping Rex 84, an introduction of Rex 84, martial law, gradually over a relatively long period of time, rather than doing it in one fell swoop, kind of like a Reichstag scenario, stage an incident and then ring down the curtain. The war on drugs, in my opinion, to a certain extent at least, represents a gradual introduction of martial law, at least in those areas where it's being put into effect most severely. And again, the constitutional implications of using the military in a civilian law enforcement capacity couldn't be exaggerated. And again, my forecast, my statements appear to have been correct, and I'm not saying that with any degree of arrogance. I wish I was wrong about some of these things, because it frankly sickens me and it frightens me, also makes me mad as hell. But again, by way of reviewing information and also at the same time looking ahead to what I feel is a very dark future, I'm going to review this article from the San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, April 24th of 1990. This is an article by Ron Harris of the Los Angeles Times. It's Dateline Chicago, and it's headlined, "Experts Say the War on Drugs Has Turned into a War on Blacks." And it reads as follows, or in part as follows. "Maybe no one planned it, maybe no one wanted it, and certainly few saw it coming, but around the country, politicians, public officials, and even many police officers and judges say the nation's war on drugs has, in effect, become a war on black people. As America's cities and towns, led by President Bush and drug czar William Bennett, have intensified the battle against drugs, particularly cocaine, these authorities say, The efforts have been disproportionately concentrated in black communities. Although it is clear that whites sell most of the nation's cocaine and account for 80% of its consumers, law officers and judges say it is blacks and other minorities who continue to fill up America's courtrooms and jails, largely because in a political climate that demands that something be done, they are the easiest people to arrest. Skipping down, and there's a quote here from Norval Morris, of the University of Chicago professor. The whole law and order movement that we've heard so much about is in operation anti-black and anti-underclass, Morris said. Not in plan, not in design, not in intent, but in operation, unquote. Well, I'm not at all sure that it was not planned that way. I hope he's right, but I'm afraid he's wrong, and again, it was just exactly such a prediction was made on this broadcast, some months, maybe a year and a half ago, when the whole thing began to escalate.